collaborative.
Experimentation.
The next idea.
We need a participation revolution, and we need it fast.
Let's say your boss wants you to assemble a team to work on a complex problem at your company or your agency or your nonprofit. Now, you think about your best and brightest people with some knowledge of the problem, and you buy them some bagels and coffee, and you all get together, right? Well, you might not be approaching this kind of problem solving in the best way. Here to talk about that is Scott Page. He is the author of the book, The Diversity Bonus. Welcome to The Next Idea.
Thanks. Great to be here.
I think our instinct is to get the smartest people in the room, right, and get to work. Why is that not the best approach?
It's not the best approach because the problems we face today are complex. They're high dimensional, they're nonlinear, they're difficult to solve. And so the best team will typically consist of talented, diverse people as opposed to sort of, quote unquote, the best people.
So when you say diverse, I mean, we think of identity diversity,
right?
Like black and white. So it's race, it's religion, it's ethnicity. That's not what you're talking
gender,
about.
Gender, physical ability, that sort of stuff. Yeah, so in the book, there's two levels of argumentation. The first is when you're dealing with a complex problem, you need cognitive diversity. You need people who see the problem differently. You need people who know different ways of attacking the problem, bring different models to bear, bring different perspectives, those sorts of things. So the question is, where does that come from? Like, you know, how do you seek out cognitive diversity? And what you find is that cognitive diversity tends to come in different identity packages. So you want people who not only were trained differently and have different experiences, you also want people who come from different identity groups, typically. I mean, it's going to depend on the problem, right? So some problems, identity is going to matter a lot. Like if we're designing a healthcare policy, if we're thinking about environmental policy, if you're talking about the lottery, you want people who sort of come from different places thinking about how do we design this policy? How do we solve this problem? How do we make this evaluation? In other cases, if it's more of an engineering problem, identity may matter less.
So I'm a manager, a mid-level manager. I've been told to put together a team. I want to put this into practice. How do I tell whether I've got cognitive diversity in my team? I mean, I don't know all of these people that well.
Right. I think that's the real challenge here is when you think about team composition, you've got to sit back and really thoughtfully imagine what are the sort of sets of skills, experiences, understandings, backgrounds that might be useful in constructing a team. One of the examples I give in the book is, you know, 150 years ago, it's a Michigan logging camp, and I'm going to hire people to chop down trees. That's a pretty simple hiring task. I line people up, I see who's best at chopping down trees, and I hire those people. Actually, they do one other thing. They count your teeth because you had to have enough teeth to be able to eat enough meat to continue to chop down trees the next
okay.
day.
All right.
But essentially, like, ability is well-defined, right? And so the quality of the team or the performance of the team is like the sum of the individual parts, right? If you think of putting a team together, you know, think of like when Target moved into Canada. This is one of my neighbors, Jay Grusin, gives us an example of a failure of diversity.
You're talking about Target, the retailer.
Yeah, that's right. They moved into Canada, and they had someone who's great at marketing move in, but they didn't have anybody with any understanding of logistics, really, who moved in. And so it was a logistics nightmare. You might not know, but Canada uses the metric system. You know, so a lot of boxes were falling off shelves. So it's just an example where when you think about any sort of business decision, there might be, you know, human resource aspects, there might be organizational aspects, there might be logistic aspects, there might be environmental issues. There's all these dimensions to a problem, to a task. And if you're only looking through a few windows, if you're not looking sort of from multiple perspectives at that problem, anything you don't look at could go wrong.
So you don't know what you don't know.
You don't know what you don't know. And the other thing that when you get back to identity diversity, one thing that's interesting about sort of both identity diversity and background diversity is if I'm in a room with engineers or if I'm in a room with women, if you're in a room with people different from you, you tend to have to work through your arguments more carefully. If you and I have the same background, we're trained in the same way, I can say, oh, hey, markets work. And you're like, hey, yeah, you're right, markets work. We're economists, then we move on.
Yeah, there's no shorthand.
Yeah, but there's no shorthand. If there's a sociologist in the room, they're going to be like, wait a minute, markets don't always work here. And then you have to walk through the logic of do they work, and you might find out, ah, maybe we jumped to a conclusion that we shouldn't have. I think the other thing, when you think about populating teams, it's not only what you should do, it's what you should not do. So my friend Sheen Levine talks about the siren call of sameness, which is that, like, hey, someone who looks like me and thinks like me, he's smart, right? And we tend to want to be in groups. It's more comfortable to be in groups of people who look like us and think like us. If you're dealing with a hard problem, what you want to do is you want to surround yourself with talented people who think differently than you do.
Let's step back for a second. I want to challenge you just a bit.
Yeah.
You've worked with places like Google, Boeing, Ford, NASA. Some of these places have been assembling teams for a long time. They have some experience at successful team building.
Right.
Why do you feel your cognitive diversity approach is better than whatever they've devised over the years?
part of it, so each one of these places is seeking out cognitive diversity. So they'll do things like a place like Boeing or Northrop will make sure when they're putting people on a project that they've taken people who've worked on different projects. Because if I've worked on a plane and you've worked on a submarine, we've learned different lessons. And so if we're designing some new thing, you want both of us, right? And you want engineers who've gone to different schools, that sort of stuff, right?
So you're saying this is something they recognize, they just didn't have a name for it.
Well, they do have a name. They have a name for it, but they're each doing it sort of in different ways. And they're not worried about sort of drawing general lessons and sort of necessarily coming at this from a scientific perspective. They're more sort of brass tacks, how do we do this better? So if you go to a place like Google, one of the things that, like, they make hiring decisions, they make, you know, promotion decisions, they make salary decisions with teams of people, not with individuals, because they know teams do better. Everybody's constantly sort of pushing, how do we construct the best possible teams? What sort of diversity do we need? But the difference is, and this is, I think, what makes the problem just so fascinating from a scientific perspective, is what diversity is relevant depends on who you are. So if we go to Harrah's, I was talking about this in my class today, if we go to, you know, a big casino operation, they really care about quantitative diversity, quantitative people, and qualitative people, because they've got lots of data on how much people make. So they need people who are good at numbers. But those people aren't good at all the other things that are important in a casino, like entertainment, design, those sorts of things. When they put together a team, they're counting how many quantitative people are here, how many qualitative people are here, right? That's a key dimension of diversity to them. At a place like Boeing, it may be that everybody's quantitative. You know, there's not as much aesthetic concern with a tank or a submarine. It's mostly an engineering problem. So all these places are playing in this space, experimenting in this space, searching in this space, to how do we construct the most innovative, amazing team? So Astro Teller, who runs Google X, they're like cutting edge thing. He has these wonderful quotes about how, like, diversity is not some touchy-feely, you know, oh, it's the right thing to do sort of thing. Diversity is what really drives innovation at Google, and they're constantly challenged, as is Northrop, as is Boeing, as is Ford, as is NASA, to think about what sort of diverse teams are the most fertile. The point, though, is that what's the most fertile at Harrah's is not what's the most fertile at Google, and it's also not what's the most fertile at the Fed. You need different types of diversity for different problems.
So tell me, how do you tell? What evidence do you look at to determine whether teams with cognitive diversity actually produce better results than simply putting together the team of your best and brightest?
You know, I came at this as a trained as an academic theorist. So I was one of those professors at Michigan who sits around and writes things in white chalk on chalkboards and said, there, I proved it. And over the last decade, I've been out visiting, you know, hundreds of organizations and talking to them and looking at their data. And there's also been a lot of, like, large-scale academic studies looking at, like, every paper ever published, every patent ever produced, those sorts of things, looking at tens of thousands of predictions by economists. And one of the things you see when you look across this sort of landscape of just massive data that didn't exist a decade ago is two things: that more talented teams do better, which is what we'd expect, and more diverse teams do better, which is what we'd expect. But the bonus, the reason I call the book The Diversity Bonus, the bonus from diversity exceeds what we would have thought of. So let me just give sort of one example with respect to prediction. If you invest in stocks, if one stock returns 10%, the other stock returns 6%, on average you get 8%. If two people make predictions and you're, like, suppose the average person makes an error of like 100 or something and you're 10% better and I'm only 8% better, you'd think if you averaged our predictions, we'd be 9% better. That's not true, because the thing is, with predictions, there's actually, you can prove this mathematically, which I show in the book, there's a bonus, because it could be that if we're wrong in opposite directions, like you're a little bit too high, a little bit too low, those errors, that diversity will kind of cancel out and we do better. So it turns out, I'm looking at, this is one of the examples of like 50,000 forecasts, the very best economist is 10% better than the average economist. The second best economist is 9% better. If you average the two of them, you get 18% better, right? Which is like totally counterintuitive, because we tend to think of diversity from a portfolio perspective, not from a bonus perspective. And so what I show in the book is all sorts of sort of empirical examples where this bonus exists. And to be honest, you know, the Mellon Foundation asked me to write the book. If I could have made up the data 10 years ago, somebody said, hey, Scott, make up your own data, I wouldn't have dared make up some of this data. No, we just
that outlandish.
Yeah, because if you'd have said to me, how much better would adding the second best economist be? I'd have said, yeah, maybe you go from 10 to 12. Because, you know mathematically it's got to be a little bonus. But the fact that it goes from 10 to 18 just
throws everybody off.
Yeah, but the reason it does, again, is that, like, you know, you've got a fancy model, I've got a fancy model. If it turns out when you happen to be high, mine happens to be low, because we're looking at the world in different ways, this is why it's all about diversity, collectively we do really, really well.
I got a couple of kids in college now, and I often hear just how much they hate working with a team of fellow students for all the reasons you think. You know, they don't show up, they don't share the work, they don't bring anything to the table. So if you're working at a place where it seems that teams are just as dysfunctional as these student teams, how can they achieve better results with this concept of diversity bonus in mind?
I think one of the most perplexing aspects in thinking about diversity bonuses and thinking about diverse groups is this. If we're in a group of people who all are trained in the same way, think in the same way, we're really likely to agree. And so we're likely to walk out of that meeting saying, that was a great meeting. We just had an excellent choice. And we don't see the counterfactual. If I'm in a meeting with a bunch of people who think differently than I do, then I'm going to lose the vote sometimes. It's not going to be 7-0, 7-0, 7-0, 6-1, right? It's going to be 4-3 or 3-3-1 or 3-2-2, and I'm going to lose. So I'm going to walk out of that meeting and thinking, darn it, I thought this was the best thing, but in fact, we're doing something else. I think that's a mistake. So the lived experience, and so in the book, there's a follow-up by Catherine Phillips. A friend of mine wrote in the book sort of a critique of the book, and one of the points she brings up in her research is that it's not necessarily more fun being in a diverse group, and it's not necessarily the case that you think you do better. So she has this wonderful experiment where people vote on how good they think their groups are. The diverse groups do better, but people in the homogeneous groups think their groups are better because everybody agrees with them. And so the funny thing is, if the group never disagrees with you, it can't be smarter than you, and you didn't need the group, right? That's the thing you got to remember. So like, if you walk out of a meeting and you get outvoted, you just have to say, well, unless I'm suddenly took some smart pill and I never make a mistake, that was probably a good thing, right? But that's a very hard place to be at, right?
That gets into Thaler's rationality.
Yeah. No. This is what, right, self-confirming biases and all that sort of stuff. But I mean, it gets back to this idea of this kind of like siren call of sameness in the sense that it's just kind of easier to be with people and understand people who think like you and make the same choices as you, and you all agree and you all feel confident in that.
But you might not have the
overwhelming evidence
results.
Shows you're more likely to fail. Homogeneity is like the route to a B minus. You know, I mean, all the amazing stuff, I mean, Hamilton, the play, look at all the any like really amazing things. It's typically coming from diverse sets of people.
Scott Page is the author of the book, The Diversity Bonus. He's also a professor of complex systems, political science, and economics at the University of Michigan. Thanks for joining us on The Next Idea.
Yeah, great to be here. Thank you.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.